Rabbiting on. Rabbiting on.
Welcome to the podcast. I am still not over the excitement of having our own jingle. I'm Rabbi Miriam Berger, and joining me today, as usual, are my friends and colleagues, Rabbi Robin Ashworthstein and Rabbi Debbie Young Summers. Nice to see you both.
Hello.
It's lovely to be here. I gather Mazel Tovs are in order, Miriam, as FRS has been awarded something? Highly commended.
That is very lovely of you. Yes, FRS and Aleph have both got a highly commended for the Stanford St. Martin's Trustees Award. It's a broadcasting award. They actually contacted us at FRS to say they were opening up the realm of awarding what is broadcasting over the pandemic, looking at how faith communities and education resources were being produced and broadcasted during the pandemic. And our amazing group of volunteers who usually run in-person Holocaust Memorial Day workshops at FRS for the local secondary schools in the area had done an amazing piece of work in being able to bring those resources online and to be able to interview and work with survivors in that way. So I was really thrilled for them and very proud of the award. Thank you and well done, Aleph.
Amazing. I wonder, this is for another episode, but I think there's something so interesting about how the technology that we have now is going to allow us to record and preserve those stories in a way that disasters haven't been able to be remembered like that before. How was everyone's week otherwise?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what's happened in the week. It's hard, isn't it, sometimes to reflect on it. We went away actually to Wales, South Wales, to the coast. I got to be by the sea for Anthony's mum's surprise 70th, which amazingly we got to do given all of the restrictions and everything. We did it all legally and it was just wonderful. The first time all the grandkids were together because we've got a new one. He's only 5 months old. And yeah, it was gorgeous. It was so nice to be away, although still struggling with the transition to being with people. Still, you know, just like loads of people. We went to this amusement park thing and there were just hundreds of people in the penguin colony. And I was like, oh, so many people and so many penguins.
But I bet the penguins were thinking the same. They must be out of practice having visitors too.
I really struggle. It was like a zoo and I really struggle with zoos on lots of different levels. But I did think these animals who have had quiet for so many months and all of a sudden the noise and the people and, you know, they have signs, don't tap on the glass, don't touch the glass. And all the kids are obviously like, hello, lion. Hi. So you kind of, yeah, I don't know. I kind of worried about their mental health.
Although, thank goodness they were also bringing money back into those organizations, because I know that they've been really struggling without the ticket prices and without the work that they're able to do above and beyond kind of an exhibit for people to go and see. So all that ecology that needs to be done.
Absolutely.
Seems to have been a week of celebrating with parents, though. My husband Johnny was at my dad's stag night, whilst I was at his fiance's hen, which clearly means Mazel Tov to them for a few weeks when they get married. But clearly celebrating with parents is the name of the game.
Oh, Mazel Tov.
Thank you.
And that is your dad getting married before or after Father's Day?
Aha, good question. So he gets married the Sunday after, on the 27th. I was actually born on Father's Day. Always thought of myself as the greatest gift. the gift that keeps on giving. I know we don't bring a huge amount of kind of variety in terms of, you know, three women in heterosexual relationships with four children between us, ranging from kind of 10 and 6. There's not a lot of diversity here, but it does mean there's interesting overlaps in terms of, let's use Father's Day to talk about what it means to be parents and what our obligations are. What are we trying to achieve? What does it mean to be a parent? Is there a difference between being Jewish parents and any other kind of parenting?
And being rabbinic parents.
Oh, oy, the rabbi's oy, kids. Oy, oy. We've got a bad reputation.
You do, Miriam. Yeah.
No. So for those who don't know, Miriam is also a rabbi's child.
And I have my own very lovely rabbi's child. And I'm hoping that we've kind of you know, changed. When I went to study in America Hebrew Union College, I'd gone from the British kind of Jewish world where rabbis' kids had a really kind of tough ride in terms of reputation into an environment where everybody's first question was, oh, you're training for the rabbinate. Which of your parents is a rabbi? Like, it was really just like, you know, the obvious space for rabbis' kids to find themselves in training to be rabbis.
I had an amazing conversation with Micha, who is turning 6 next week, about 2.5 years ago, or just under 2.5 years ago, when we were starting to plan a trip to Israel for Gary to get ordained, my husband. I was explaining to Micha, who was about 3 at the time, that we were going to go to Jerusalem and Abba was going to have a special ceremony and become a rabbi. And Micha said, first of all, I don't want to go to Jerusalem. I want to go to Israel, because he'd been studying for your matzmut at nursery. And then he said, and I don't want Abba to be a rabbi. I only want mummy to be a rabbi. And I just wondered how many times in the world that sentence could possibly have been uttered.
I love that. Well, Gabriel's completely not sold on the rabbi thing. I asked him recently. He's nearly 9. You know, what do you want to be? And he's like, a farmer. I was like, farmer? Ooh. I was like, you're not interested in being a rabbi? No, I am not. Not interested at all. Like, vehemently opposed.
To be fair to Gabriel, my second choice of career would probably be farmer.
Farmer, there you go. He could be a rabbinic farmer. I'll keep nudging.
There is a Jewish farming movement.
Yeah, exactly. There are Jewish farms out there. So we'll
Sadeh would love that. Yeah, absolutely. Ben can't understand having mum as a rabbi and a grandpa as a rabbi. He still thinks we're both a bit crazy, because why would you not be a cantor? Because he thinks Cantor Zoe Jacobs is very much his clergy person of choice. And they do everything that rabbis can do, and they can sing. So he's totally, you know, dubious about the rabbinate, thinks the cantorate is where it's at.
Yeah, fair enough, Ben. Yeah, solid. I think that's probably quite right.
Do you think he feels pressure to pursue the cantorate because that stuff is so present in his life and everyone kind of wants to know what's Ben going to do because he's under the microscope?
I don't think so. I think he'd really like to be sort of the next Ed Sheeran if he was going to use his kind of guitar playing skills and singing to a career end. And like most 10-year-old boys, all of that would be trumped if he could get a place in, you know, the Arsenal or England teams. So I don't think he's really thinking that way. And you know, as I said to a friend years ago, you know, unless this is his absolute calling, I'd always wish on him a slightly easier career, if I was really honest.
Yeah.
You know, somewhere where he could rock up at 9 o'clock, leave at 5 o'clock. You know, I wouldn't choose to do anything else because this is my absolute who I am. It's a vocation. It's not a job. It's what I've only ever known I was going to do. But if you don't go into it like that, you know, maybe an easier life I would kind of wish on him for him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was part of why my parents were horrified when age 20 I announced I was going to become a rabbi, and that fear for parents of what are you getting yourself into?
Right.
Yeah.
But that public-private piece is a lot of that as well. You know, I've only ever lived my life in a goldfish bowl, and, you know, have to admit, I love that. I love the fact that community has always been the extension of our family, and boundaries are totally fluid, and there's a whole, you know, there's a host of people from the synagogue where I was a toddler, where my dad was the rabbi, who I still call auntie and uncle because that was our extended family, and I love that. But the fact that if that isn't you, if that doesn't come naturally, not being able to close the door and know, you know, it's the end of the working day is hard.
Yeah, I often think it's interesting you were saying about before about the kind of us three being in similar spaces and, you know, the being very connected in that sense. And I'm very aware sometimes when I'm leading a Friday night service, particularly now being in home. So I'm in this room, although with a virtual background, and Gabriel often will come in and co-lead things with me because he loves to perform. And I often worry, that was a Freudian slip. I wonder, maybe I worry as well, about everyone in their different spaces within community and what it is to be a rabbi who's certainly child is very front and center in the community. What that feels like if you are not able to have your own children, if you're single and looking for a family, or your family doesn't look like mine, you know, it looks different. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be Jewish and not look like the, you know, 2.4 whatever the family is? Not that we are quite that, but I'm always trying to think about that and hold it. And sometimes I think I end up holding Gabriel further away because of that, to be like, okay, let me just give space to it. I don't know whether I overthink these things or not, but there is something about that public-private thing, like doing the role and also holding space for other people and what that would look like to bring a child into it.
I was super aware of that when I was pregnant, that I found that bump, that pregnancy bump, was... it was really hard not to kind of wear it with smugness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't want it to be a kind of a badge of smug, but you can't put it away. And that thing of, well, how do I know what this is triggering for other people, is really hard.
Yeah,
I think that's really powerful. Laura Dana Klausner once said in one of our class at, I think we're in the third year at Lea Beck, on baby blessings. And she said, every time you celebrate anything in a community, it causes someone pain. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's an ufruf, it's someone who is still looking for love and hasn't found it. If it's a baby blessing, it's... And, you know, there were years when I was performing baby blessings and failing to get pregnant myself. Mm-hmm. And then that public-private of how our bodies, as female bodies particularly, I think, are also game within the rabbinate. I remember when I was first pregnant and I was about 3 months pregnant, starting to show, I put the baby on board badge on finally, and someone at the synagogue said, oh yes, I thought you were pregnant, I saw you'd put on a lot of weight. And the same person at one point said, oh, you young people, you do rush into IVF, don't you? We've been trying for 6 years.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness.
It was not a rushed thing. And I just think that sense, you know, well, if we experience that, then our kids are also going to experience that sense of the public and private. And going back to Rabbi Laura again, when a few years ago I did stand-up comedy at JW3 and I was trying to prepare my piece, I wanted to tell this very funny story about my eldest swearing in the bath to my mum. And Laura's advice, which I think was super wise, was be really careful about the stories you tell about your children. Because when they're 16, 17, 18, people will come back and quote those stories to them, and they're going to be mortified as teenagers that you shared that information. And I think in a world of social media where everything is so public and shareable, and, you know, I've now reached the point where I feel like I need to ask my kids' permission before I put a photo on Facebook or whatever it is, because it is very public. But also you want to share your joys and your life and be real with people. Mm-hmm.
So I know that our family home when I was really young was very much a kind of extension of the synagogue, of Northwest Surrey Synagogue. But I do have questions. You know, sadly, my mum died a number of years ago and I can't ask her this question. But how is it that every member of Northwest Surrey Synagogue that I've ever met since ordination has said to me, oh, goodness, it's so lovely to see you. I changed your nappy when you were little. I was like, how is it possible that every member of the community has that same memory that they all managed to have changed my nappy? There couldn't have been enough nappies to go round the entire community. You know, I find that piece somewhat bizarre. But my sister, I know, and I know she's listening, so Lucy, sorry if this is just another thing of what Dad used to do to you, but basically there weren't many Saturday mornings services that would go by where she wouldn't end up in tears. She's not quite as gregarious and doesn't enjoy the spotlight quite as much as me, and every story he would start a funny anecdotal sermon with was always around her. She's the oldest, and she used to be mortified week on week. Mm-hmm. But it didn't stop him.
Yeah, just carried on.
Yeah, well, it was a useful way in
to
the sermon.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because it's relatable. We want to connect to people's lives. Right?
Yeah. Miriam, I always quote one of the stories that you tell about being in the airport. Maybe you can say it about with Ben.
Oh.
It's one of my favourite stories. Because I think what's really interesting is, as you said, it's very comfortable actually to live in a world, especially I think at Gabe's age and maybe all of our kids' age. It's actually lovely. Everyone knows them. People make a fuss of them, apart from sometimes me, because I forget about that he's also a kid in the community. So he often like won't get the birthday blessing because I forget that anyway. But usually get more attention, and it's lovely. It's a space everyone knows you. But I wonder at what point, because they're young, aren't they? So at what point does that shift? But tell the story, because I tell it all the time because it's one of my favourite stories, and I think it says a lot to what we're talking about.
So it is a great story. He must have been about three, and we live just a road away from the synagogue. And so Finchley as an area of London is very much our village, because there are members of the community sort of at every turn, and we bump into people a lot. We were at Heathrow about to go on holiday, and we'd been walking around the terminal, and suddenly Ben stopped and he said to me, "Mummy, you haven't said hello to anyone since we got here." And it was just this amazing thing of, you know, there are so many people and yet why aren't you stopping to talk to them? So I went through this whole long explanation about how that's what it's like in Finchley because I'm the rabbi there and the community live nearby. But actually Heathrow is this huge airport and it serves so much of the country and people come from a long way to get their flights from there. And we're just a small community in Finchley. And of course, that's why I don't know people here at the airport as well. And he just had been sold on this as a really understandable, relatable answer as Mike Grabina, a wonderful member of FRS, walks straight up to me and goes, "Miriam, what a surprise. How nice to see you." He was traveling on business. We were going on holiday. It was just one of those perfect moments of then he knows never to believe a word I say, because you just finished the explanation and here was a member of the show.
Yeah.
It was great.
It's lovely. I love that story.
That's a great story. I've not heard that one.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating to me just how much the rabbinate has changed for us to be able to be here in this place now. The first woman rabbi, Regina Jonas, who was ordained in the 1930s in Germany, wrote in her rabbinic thesis that women could not be mothers and married as well as be rabbis, which was, of course, very much a reflection of the day. Once you married as a woman, you stopped working, whatever that work was. And for her, it was the rabbinate. And my tutor at Leo Beck College, Rabbi Michael Hilton, said to me when I started talking about getting married and having a family, and one of the things he said to me was that when women came into the rabbinate, they actually gave the men in the rabbinate permission to be better family men. And I think there's something really fascinating about how far we've come since then. I mean, that was, you know, 45 years ago, that it would never occur to us that rabbis can't be married, that rabbis can't have children. But of course, there is still massive imbalances in the expectation of who does what. And I think, you know, the last year has highlighted so much of that imbalance for lots of people outside the rabbinate, obviously, as well, that, you know, in lockdown, women have really borne the brunt of what it means to be in the workplace and to be a mother and the difficulties of that. Although I don't know about you guys, but I could not have got through the last year or be a rabbi in the way that I am without a partner that leans in and really takes up their role as a parent.
Absolutely. And I think that whole working from home thing, if anything, has actually helped in that sense, because my husband was not kind of leaving first thing in the morning and coming home late, and we were able to share things more. But I'm interested by what you said. You said we wouldn't have thought that, you know, male rabbis couldn't be parents or family men. And that's interesting because I did work experience, a long chunk of work experience with a Catholic priest, which was probably one of the most formative kind of experiences that I had in terms of what is religious leadership, because you often take for granted what's always been there and seeing it. So you grow up in a rabbi's house, you know what the rabbi does, but seeing it just with that slight difference in terms of the Catholic priesthood was fascinating for me. And it did raise a lot of questions about whether you truly can be. He was an extraordinary priest, and the church community were absolutely his family. Mm. And the kids that turned up on his doorstep, the elderly, the vulnerable that turned up day or night, because they knew that he was completely there for them. And I do often worry that people think that they're going to intrude on family time, that there's a perception that we are, you know, incredibly busy, and that piece around, you know, what we're triggering in our own, you know, solid family relationships. What does that mean when people see us? And, well, does that mean we failed in some way because we can't replicate the rabbi's family? You know, I was often used as the rabbi's, well, Miriam's allowed to do that. You know, and that thing of we are seen as a kind of mirror for other people. And I do worry that, you know, we are pulled in a lot of directions.
Yeah.
And does that mean we're not 100% there for the people we would like to be there for?
Mm. You know, although I think what you're saying is what the workplace has said to women for hundreds of years and has said, you can't do all of this, so we're not going to let you. And there's that challenge of actually men and women both need to lean in and both need to take on these responsibilities. And you know, couples of all colour and type and mix and single parents. I mean, like, you know, one of my best friends is a single mum. I have no idea how she does all the things she does. It's astonishing.
What I really find fascinating is the idea of our role and how I used to, probably before I was ordained, say, you know, it's kind of like being a parent to the community or being a mother to the community, that you're, and this sense that I carry deeply, which I think is not helpful, that I'm a mother and that I am 24/7 available for like the community and for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's like a gendered construction that is handed to us. And certainly I went to an all girls school. I was told you can have it all. You can mm-hmm. have the family, you can have the career. What no one told me was that, one, that's exhausting. Two, it's not sustainable. And three, it's a terrible model. Because now I'm in community, I know that my greatest role is empowering everyone. It's to be an adult, not a parent, actually, and for them not to be children, but for us all to adult, be in relationship, and to have really clear boundaries. And I do think that being a rabbi, being a priest, an imam, is a patriarchal model that doesn't, that to fit in as a woman, we have to do certain things that can feel not okay, and that just, for me anyway, I feel kind of torn and trying to balance always and like what that looks like. And actually, because there can be sometimes no space for it. And yet there's great blessing in it because Gabriel's part of the community and I don't have to separate my home to life. But I do, yeah, this thing of like being a parent and being a rabbi in community and what that is. Like I'm actually only a parent to Gabriel. But just all these kind of subconscious things that I tell myself and people expect as well of us is really interesting.
It just reminds me, Robin, of what you said. It's slightly off the topic, but people quite often ask Gary what he thinks of women rabbis. Like, does he think of me as a women rabbi? Does he think of me as a rabbi? And I really hope he doesn't, because I don't think he'd want to go to bed at night with his rabbi. I don't want to be his rabbi or the kids' rabbi. I want to be able to be a yeah. wife and a mum and other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you guys feel like you've learnt anything spiritually from being parents?
Oh, that's a great question.
I certainly have learnt a new definition of the word miracle. Mm. That actually, I think when I, you know, when you talk to teenagers or children about kids, about babies, about how we come into the world, there's biology there. And when you actually experience motherhood, there's something truly miraculous. And for me, that piece around what, you know, what is God, what is miracle, when this is not just cells reproducing, this is something truly extraordinary. I think for me, that piece that is, we can explain things with science and biology, but there's something other in this. I think for me, the experience of motherhood has been the closest I've got to seeing God in the world.
Mm, yeah, that's so powerful. I think that, and what I've realised is that I don't have a sense of entitlement to anything. I think that's what I've realised, is that like most of this is it's like the miracle, but most of it is outside of my control, like fertility, infertility, right? Things are going to happen that I actually have no control over, which is a type of surrender as well, mm. isn't it? I think one of the biggest gifts I have that I think I have as a parent, but if in any other role you could have this as well, it's just that this is where I practice it most, is about how we communicate and how we see the holy in each other. So like trying to teach Gabriel always about being emotionally literate, being able to see and hear and feel what he's feeling, giving him space to express that, which I think for a young boy is hopefully a massive gift. But that to me feels like sacred work of how do you help someone see the holy in them, the divine. And I always say to Gabriel, you know, who do we love? And he goes, I love myself first. I'm like, great. Because I think if he can hold that, and that to me is like, that is a service. That is me doing my work as a Jew of saying, we're all created in the image of God and you are going to be able to love yourself and also be able to express and see that in other people. But the way that he's able to be emotionally literate for me is a sacred act, if that makes sense. So that I see as being like the biggest duty I have. And like I say, I can do that parenting, but yes, hopefully I also do that out in the world. It's not exclusive to parenting. Everyone can access that. But for me, it's helped me like focus on that as being important. What about you, Debbie?
Well, I love that you guys talk about kind of the miracle and the beauty of it all, because I think it's the hard times in parenting that I felt have taught me a little bit about mm-hmm. what it's like to be God. Mm-hmm. I had this moment when Eliana was about 8 or 9 weeks old, And, you know, as I said earlier, we had worked for 6 years to create this miracle and to make this thing happen. And at one point we thought we wouldn't ever have children of our own. And, you know, it was this amazing miracle, and she would not stop crying. And we couldn't work out what was wrong.
Turn it upside down. What's
tried
wrong?
Everything. We, you know, we'd fed her, we'd changed her, we'd made her warmer, made her cooler. We'd done hours of crying. And I suddenly wondered if this is what it's like for God, who has invested so much in the miracle of creation and in generating this magnificent world for us. And we just keep screaming and crying and complaining, and God cannot work out what on earth is wrong with us and why we're not happy. Mm. And just this lack of understanding between you and this creature that you've created. And I wonder if God the Mother is sometimes baffled, or if not often baffled, by our ridiculous behaviour on earth.
It's a great understanding of why we go from, in Torah, the creation story, into a whole book of dysfunctional family stories, right? The whole of Genesis is based in family narratives where there's everything you could get wrong in family life is all thrown in there, whether it's sibling rivalry or parents with favorite children. That whole piece around, these are all the reasons why I see you as the crying children that I can't work out. You know, why can't you do this properly?
I got into huge trouble once talking about the flaws of the biblical family characters and the biblical characters generally. I was chatting to Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra on Muslim TV, and I talked about how inspiring I find it that our patriarchs and matriarchs were not perfect people. These ancient parents made loads of mistakes and had terrible relationships, and their parenting was shocking in cases, you know, favorite children and the wrong one was the favorite. And in the Muslim tradition, you cannot find flaws in the prophets. And it was just such a different approach to what inspires us. It was so interesting.
It's really interesting. And I'm sure we could have like another podcast episode about God, because for me, God's like, I don't understand God as being a personal God with feelings or in that kind of way. And I remember I was actually at Miriam Shaw, being a student rabbi, and it was before the High Holy Days, and I had a sermon slot, big one for a student rabbi. Did not know what to say, was just really struggling for inspiration. And Gabriel said to me one night, "Mummy, what does God look like?" And because I don't have a personal idea of God, or like I don't talk in that way, I tried my hardest to be like, well, you know, God is an experience of being part of nature. It's about the universe we're in. It's about love. It's about, what does God look like, Mummy? I was like, well, God doesn't really have a form. It's more how you, and he just would not accept it at all. Like really was angry with me that I couldn't say this is what God looked like. And eventually my really good friend, Rabbi Daniel Lichtman, was over, and I said, Dan, I don't know what to say. Like, he's really upset about it. I don't know how to explain that God isn't in, you know, for me. And he said, Gabriel, look into my eyes. Gabriel looked into his eyes, said, can you see God there? And Gabriel went, oh yeah, I can see God. He's like, great, I can see God in your eyes too. It was so powerful and so beautiful, because what Daniel did was brought the tangible to something that I find it hard to express, because I don't, you know, I understand God in such an ethereal, there's no end, there's no limit to God, Ein Sof, but actually in the personal, in the relationship. And I was always really grateful for that. I don't know whether Gabriel remembers it or not, but I do go back to it sometimes.
That's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And there's something else there as well, which is, I think, one of the most powerful things of parenting is that somehow our children manage to push us out of our comfort zones all the time. That, you know, however much we think that they're going to kind of replicate our values or see the world in the way we do just inherently, there's something incredibly powerful about the fact that children seem to be there to just push the envelope a little bit and to push us into those spaces that are not our, not in our natural comfort zone. So I think that is definitely where that concept of parenting takes us, whether, you know, as we look back over this half an hour, whether it's about kind of the public and private spaces in which our families operate, whether it's about how community takes on a particular place within our own lives, our children's lives, what's our relationship to the community. I hope that as we start edging towards Father's Day and that people are able, please God, to celebrate with those that are their dads, or dads are able to celebrate with their children. But I recognize that for so many, Father's Day brings a huge amount of pain, whether it's because of their own relationship with their dads, whether it's because their beloved dads are no longer with them. And Debbie, we're thinking of you on Father's Day as well.
Thank you.
The pain that can be these days that have a tagline like Father's Day, but can be so difficult for so many people. And I would just love to say a big thank you to the companies who have realized over the last couple of years that actually marketing emails and things like that on Mother's Day and Father's Day and are really hard for some people. And that opt-out button, which seems to be the new thing, I have a lot of respect. So thank you for those whoever dreamt that up. I do remember sending a very angry email many years ago when I got my first Mother's Day advertising email after I'd lost my mum, and I knew it was going to an unmonitored email address, but it didn't stop me writing the email. I felt the need to. So I'm glad all these years later that people are doing something about that.
Yeah.
We used to have lots of conversations in our family about how commercialized Mother's Day and Father's Day were, and therefore that's not our thing. And it just makes me wonder now, as reform communities, when we really want to celebrate so many different kinds of families, adopted parents and single parents and LGBTQ plus parenting and mixed faith families and all those different models of what it means to Parents Day. Maybe we need to have a Reform Judaism Parenting Day rather than Mother's Day and Father's Day, in that sense of let's celebrate all the ways that people in our communities nurture the young and create the future for our communities in some way, as RS Wainetza does for many of our young people. You know, all these different ways that Jewish education and parenting happens. It's never just about whoever you're born to. There is so much that goes into to parenting and raising children.
This has given us so many jumping off points for so many other topics that I hope we won't lose any of them, because I definitely want to take on Robin's challenge of talking about God. I think there's a huge piece that's come up about, well, what are we passing on to our children? Debbie mentioned RS Wainetza, but that thing of youth movements, Jewish schools, I think there's a whole nother topic of conversation there about how we teach, how we pass on to our children, which I would love to be able to kind of work into our conversations at some point as well.
And this weekend, Father's Day is 2 weeks' time, but this weekend we're also marking the birthday of Her Majesty the Queen. She's also a mother figure, I think, for some people. Mm. There's this kind of, I mean, she's certainly got her own clan to mother.
Doesn't have it easy, does she?
It's not an easy job, is it? She might have some interesting things to say about that public versus private piece in parenting. But a happy birthday to Her Majesty the Queen when she celebrates her official birthday on the 12th of June. And before we finish, a reminder to you all that you can subscribe. Take us with you wherever you're going. If you're off for a walk, driving in the car, going on a run. Although I cannot personally run to podcasts, I need really strong music to move that fast. But tell your friends, rate us if you feel you want to. You can find us everywhere that you find podcasts. And we also wanted to mention that it has been so fabulous to receive emails and letters and tweets from so many of you. And not just a thank you for the podcast, or we've really enjoyed it, but people really thinking about the topics and sending us their thoughts and ideas. And we've just been really, really grateful that you've thought so deeply and engaged so much with our chats together. So thank you for joining us on our rabbiting on in the community. Maybe we need some merch now, get people really engaged.
A jingle and merch. I'd be mind blown.
I'd love that. Let's do it. Let's have it. With our lovely community out there, we could continue to be community and brand ourselves. Why not? We love the comments and the depth of the comments, Twitter and email. So please continue to be in touch with us and help us shape this as well. We've got some really great ideas and love having conversations with you and hearing your stories. So get in touch at media@rjuk.org or on our Twitter handle @reformmovement. Just keep in touch with us and we'll keep rabbiting on.
Lovely to talk to you, and lovely to have so many listeners with us as well. And Happy Father's Day to those who are able to celebrate.
Bye.